Reading from the gospel this morning is called the Little Apocalypse, and it's not hard to see why. Image after image of tumult, earthquakes, famine, plague, nations at odds, valued institutions deconstructed stone by stone, leaders who attack ordinary citizens. Taken together, they paint a picture of the end of the world as we know it. Am I the only one who thinks this sounds familiar? I try to be balanced in receiving a broad spectrum of network news during an election. So over the past 2 weeks, I've watched Fox News and CNN and PBS on my phone. Sort of equal opportunity punishment, really. It's somehow easier to take all that on such a small screen, though. On Wednesday, a parishioner taught me how to use the mute button. So, but voices across the political spectrum are riled up. You know that. There will be a peaceful transfer of power on January 20th. Thank goodness. But I don't know a single family that isn't experiencing division within it right now. Disappointment and elation both are to be expected with any significant election. But the level of anxiety present in every corner of our country is new. Now I can hear you muttering, "You mean to tell me I got the kids and myself dressed and got to church this morning and that's what you have to offer me, preacher?" You're probably thinking, we need some good news. Well, in 1938, Langston Hughes wrote, "Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme that any man be crushed by one above. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I'm the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land. Oh yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plains, all and all the stretch of these great green states and make America again." Believe it or not, the folks who first heard this gospel would have taken it for comfort. In those days, apocalyptic passages were offered to help believers faced with oppression or persecution put their pain in a larger context. The images of the ground shaking or the wind blowing outside were meant to be a mirror held up to reflect their internal storms. of betrayal, of poverty, of degradation. Like Langston Hughes' poem, the biblical narrative offers the reality of things stirred up, mountains falling and water crashing, as creation's writhing affirmation of the beautiful struggle within the individual's beating breast. And God is in all of it. You may not be safe all the time. The scripture says you may be arrested or even put to death, but you are never alone. I've had to work hard personally to come to terms with the language in today's gospel. Growing up in East Tennessee and Arkansas, Bible verses that talked about final judgment always gave me the heebie-jeebies. There were snake handlers at our little county fair, and they quoted alarming Bible verses on their hand-painted signs. A little church down the street from our house in Little Rock seemed to preach only hellfire and damnation. And I remember watching with some alarm the people who'd fainted being carried outside every Sunday by the Ushers Guild and the Nurses Auxiliary. Once, there was a preacher who stoked the fires of ecstasy in his small congregation. As he preached, he would pause periodically and ask for a show of hands from those who were ready to go to heaven and meet their Maker. First, about half the congregation raised their hands. So he went on preaching with even more passion. When he asked the congregation a second time, who's ready to go to heaven and meet their Maker? 3/4 of the group raised their hands. So he pulled out all the stops and preached the gospel the best way he knew how. When he asked the congregation the third time, who is ready to go to heaven and meet their Maker? Everyone in the church raised their hand except one fellow. After the service, the preacher found the man and asked him why he had not raised his hand. Well, preacher, he said, I surely do want to go to heaven and meet my Maker, but it sounded like you were loading up the bus and going tonight. But when we let Jesus' words about earthquakes and final conflict be about our personal battles and our responsibilities, I think we can make more sense of them. Consider Moses and Pharaoh, and let both sides of that battle be within you. How are you trapped? And how do you enslave others? I know it's hard. But both are true. Consider brother Jacob and brother Esau wrestling not on a riverbank through the night, but squared off inside of you. Neither one is all right and good, nor the other all wrong and bad. How are your external fights mirrored within your own divided self? Consider Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Mary and Martha. Isn't the resolution of conflict always about slaying the dragon of competition? Always about piercing the lie we tell ourselves about there being limited love and resources? We buy that hook, line, and sinker that there's not enough love to go around, and there is, and enough resources for everything we need. It's unlimited, it's overflowing, it's abundant, as big as the love of God. And it's a lie to ever believe that there's not enough. Isn't the resolution of conflict always about dealing with the anxiety about the other? We've heard language over the last months and witnessed actions that objectify women, that belittle minorities, that demonize other nations, and such behavior has damaged us. I'm not sure we're a shining city on a hill right now. We've revealed that America may not be exceptional. You see, generous-spirited Christians realize that evil is not out there in some enemy or foreign nation. Rather, we always fight the good fight within ourselves. So we have to reclaim the vision. The success of representative democracy requires mutual respect. It requires honoring differences. It requires knowing that the happiness of anyone is dependent on the plight of the many, and that that fragile beacon cannot be taken for granted. It has to be sparked in each individual, rekindled in every generation. Taylor Branch said last week, our nation and our faith are founded on two principles that we often turn inside out. With the Constitution and the Bible in our hands, we are called to be self-disciplined and to have faith in the other. But right now in America, we're much more likely to have enormous, even indulgent faith in ourselves and to project discipline and judgment on the other. What if we practice turning that around? Because, you know, it turns out that the gift of America can't be inherited. Each of us has to make it. Several years ago, my 10th grade class and I made a similar discovery. We were reading the epic poem Beowulf, and in discussing the main character's terrifying battle under the earth, we learned something striking about ourselves. Once upon a time, in a land far away, Beowulf sails to the land of the Danes to slay a shadowy figure, an enemy who kills without being seen. For 12 long winters, the Danes have been held hostage by this stalker who never lets them rest. In the first battle between good and evil, Beowulf slays Grendel, who limps home mortally wounded and dies. But to end the horror, Beowulf must then fight Grendel's parent. Both creatures are monstrous, called kindred of Cain, after humanity's first murderer, the one who killed Abel out of jealousy and anger. Beowulf goes after the murderer in a powerfully symbolic journey. Our superhero, sheathed in gold armor and armed with a sword which has never known defeat, dives into a turbid pool stained with blood and full of snakes. After a day of swimming downward through the chaotic water, he arrives in the enemy's lair, an underground cave lit by an unearthly fire which gives off no heat. The hero and the killer engage in a long wrestling match, Beowulf's sword useless against her, her knife unable to pierce his breastplate and helmet. And then the poet invokes God, ruler of the heavens, and Beowulf, God's human agent, is given clarity of vision. There, amidst the trash in his enemy's cave, Beowulf sees the sword that can bring him victory. It's the giant's sword with an image of Cain slaying Abel carved in its hilt. It embodies the anger of the first murder, and with it, Beowulf delivers the death stroke. You see, the enemy dies by her own weapon. Symbolically, the hero conquers the killer by letting her own evil put her down. It's an old story that's as modern as the nightly news, a cop and robber show, or a Hollywood Western. What my classes and I discovered is that in the battle between good and evil here, good triumphs because the heart of evil betrays itself. Moreover, the hero's battle is really fought within himself. His journey is raw and real and internal, which is where he slays his demon. He dives down deep and wrestles with what is shadowy and broken there. He turns to the wound and finds life. His heroism is that he engages the difficult struggle, and his prize is the wisdom born of pain. Beowulf's battle ends with something like the light of Christ, which the poet says illumines the chamber with a clearness such as a candle of heaven sheds in the sky. Well, I believe that we are invited to jump into the same tumult and to be as brave, to accept that chaos is also found within us and not to paint it always on some outside enemy, to remember that in this 240-year-old experiment in democracy, our work is to make America again and again and again, so that if we are called to face evil without, we will do it as practice, self-aware, empathic heroes. For when we dive into the struggles that are our own to tackle, as individuals, as a country, and as a world, what we find there is that God is all and all in all. And in that all, there will surely be earthquakes and battles, or worse sometimes. But God is discovered and made manifest in this dark and beautiful struggle, accompanying us through what has to die and empowering our humanity to gain its very soul. Amen.